The following programming is sponsored by the Museum of Sports. The views expressed do not necessarily reflect the views of this station, its management, or Beasley Media Group.
All righty, every one of us is a walking museum of sports, from your first ball game with your parents to getting that first autograph at Connie Mack Stadium or Franklin Field, or taking your own kids to their first game. It's the feeling we get that brings us back to our own Philly Field of Dreams. A new Museum of Sports show is on the air and ready to go there with you. I'm Lou Scheinfeld. Our show is dedicated to sports memories, memorabilia, and the museum that'll capture it all right here in Philadelphia. We're live on Talk 860 and on the Facebook pages of the Museum of Sports and Talk 860. So take a look. The Museum of Sports Show is brought to you by Tepachi Franklin Cardiovascular Center. They are the specialists in non-invasive treatment. And if there's anything you want with your heart, it's non-invasive treatment. Joining me today as co-host is the Museum of Sports Director of Outreach, Susan Baxter. Doug Scheimela is off today, but Susan, what's on your mind today?
Well, before we get into the groove of talking about our local Eagles, local football team, I just have to say that my Broncos actually have a quarterback. They had one previously, and he's doing well in Pittsburgh, but I'm very impressed with Bo Nix. I'm excited, and he is hopefully going to be the future of the Broncos organization and future victories and success for the team.
Well, you know, the Broncos have a pretty good kicker by the name of Will Lutz. And he came from New Orleans. He was there for several years under the coach that went over to Denver. And he's a friend of our family, married to the daughter of one of our dearest friends, and a wonderful guy. And I'm so happy that he is doing well. When you see what happens to kickers when they start to lose it. And Will is a great guy. His wife and they have a baby. Just wonderful, classy people. And I always check the box score. Last week, he had 6 extra points and 2 field goals. Yeah, he's
perfect. Very well for the team. Yeah. It was a nice game. It was fun with the Browns. The Browns are a great organization, too. They have a lot of future with Winston. He is a class act of a quarterback over there. Everybody always roots for the underdogs, right? And I always feel like the Browns were always the underdog of the AFC. So,
all right. Well, we've got a great show coming up with the great Merle Reese and the great J. Russell Peltz. But first, I just have to comment on another brilliant column by the Wall Street Journal's Jason Gay. What? The Wall Street Journal has a sports columnist? Actually, they have 3, and they're damn good writers, too. Well, Jason was in Baltimore for the Eagles game last Sunday. I'm going to read you part of his column that I think Eagles fans will enjoy. Now, this is a national newspaper read by millions. Literally, their circulation is in the millions. So he starts off by saying, noisy and gleeful, they made their presence known early, and as the fourth quarter ticked down in chilly Baltimore, the visiting flock began filling the lower half of the stadium, claiming another area as their own. Bright green and barrel-chested, the interlopers from up Interstate 95 weren't hard to identify. They were Eagles fans, as in the loud, proud fans of Philadelphia football Eagles, a strange NFL species, aggressively passionate, seldom content, and never shy. On Sunday, their beloved squad won their 8th game in a row, defeating the scattershot Ravens 24-19 and lifting their record to a soaring 10-2 with 5 regular season games remaining. Oh, everybody's buzzing about the Lions, the Bills, the Chiefs, Vikings, Steelers. Hold on. Philadelphia's right there, too. Eagles fans have a unique relationship with good news. It triggers a deep-seated fear the other cleat is about to drop. But this grinding defense-first team has become hard to deny. Philadelphia is a punishing physical squad that is getting stronger at the right time in the December cold. We've got a tough team, says Eagle coach Nick Sirianni. Vibes are high. Last year was a disastrous campaign for Philadelphia. The team started 10-1, lost 5 of 6 to finish 11-6, and got chased out of the playoffs by the Buccaneers in the opening round. It couldn't have ended worse. This season, amid a middling 2-2 start, the Bluebirds started hooting for Sirianni, followed by predictable speculation he could be replaced, perhaps by crusty wizard Bill Belichick. But Sirianni didn't help matters by verbally tangling with local fans after a narrow win over Cleveland. Hot seat gossip and sideline meltdowns can unravel a team. It didn't happen. These Eagles and their fervent head coach may be an acquired taste, but results are results. They haven't lost since late September. That 2023 collapse feels like someone else's bad dream. Last year is over, Sirianni said. We don't care about last year. That's our Eagles. And I got to tell you, he captured the fans. They fill those stadiums and the national telecasts. They're not Philadelphia homers. They show all the green. They show all these players. And when the game gets bad for the home team, like you said, we start moving down into the front seats. We take over. They take over the bars, the town, everything. Anyway, just darn good writing. Coming up in a bit is Philadelphia's own boy wonder, J. Russell Peltz, the great boxing promoter, who has some thoughts on whether Joe Frazier's historic but abandoned old boxing gym up on Broad Street should be saved. And later, our king of sports collectibles, Nick DiPaci Jr., is here to talk about what's hot and what's affordable in the memorabilia market, and to let you know how you can get a sneak peek at what'll be in the Museum of Sports from the world-class DiPaci memorabilia collection. But first, on the line and live on Facebook with us is one of Philadelphia's greatest living legends, a local boy who's made it big with his voice and his passion and has been calling the Eagles games on radio for an astounding 50-plus years. It's our good friend and regular guest, the one and only Merrill Reese. Merrill, thanks for coming on. I know it might be a little too chilly for golf today, so we kept you indoors, but how are you?
I am fine, Lupe. You made me a little bit older. It's only 48 years.
Oh, it's only 40. It seems like 75.
It seems like 100, but it's 48.
Oh, okay. All right. Well, let's see. Who's done 50? Snyder did 50 as owner. Connie Mack did 50. Somebody else is working on. Oh, Dan Baker, he's done 50. Yeah,
so okay, Dan's done it.
You'll be in the 50 club pretty soon.
Well, I'm not going anyplace. I intend to do it forever.
There you go. You know
there's no retirement in my mind.
You know what the comedian David Wright says? He says, "I intend to live forever. So far, so good." So
yeah,
Merrill. Last year, this time, the Eagles were riding high, only to collapse and finish the season, as Jason Gay pointed out, on a dismal, dismal note. What's different this year?
Well, you can start with the coaching staff and say that Nick Sirianni is the CEO. And then you can talk about the fact that they brought in a great pair of coordinators in Vic Fangio, who had at one time been the Denver head coach, but he was at one time the Stars defensive coach many years ago, and he's one of the best defensive coordinators in football. The offensive coordinator is Kellen Moore, who was a coach. He was a player first at Boise State. Then he was a draft pick of the Detroit Lions. Then he played for the Cowboys in a backup quarterback role. After he got hurt, he joined their coaching staff, then coached with the Chargers, and now he's here. He is a bright, inventive coach. So you're dealing with a difference in philosophy. Then you can add the name of a couple of free agents. One, his name is Saquon Barkley, and he is amazing. Either this week or next week, he will take the Eagles' all-time ground-gaining record in his hands and squeeze them to death, because he is only 14 yards away from eclipsing Wilbur Montgomery, who is in the number two spot, and only 109 yards from breaking Shady McCoy's record. So you're talking about a great, great player. So those are big, big acquisitions. And then you talk about some of the things that Howie Roseman has done. In the draft, he took two players who were NFL ready from the moment they arrived, in Quinyon Mitchell and Cooper DeJean, two of the best. They could both be candidates for Pro Bowl spots. Mm-hmm. That's how good they are as rookies. He picked up a free agent from the Saints, who nobody even knew or thought about. And Vic Fangio said, here, step in the middle. You're going to play middle linebacker, even though you've never been a middle backer before. And Zach Bourne has been fantastic. So there are a lot of things that have happened to make this team different.
Well, they seem to start out slow in games, and people were getting worried that they didn't score in the first quarter in the first X amount of games. But is that attributable to changes being made quickly by some of these coaches that you just mentioned?
I think it's not how you start, but how you finish. That's what counts. Nick said the thing is they try so hard to play clean football that they move the ball well in the first quarter, and then all of a sudden they go off sides, or there's a holding penalty, or they're backed up into a third and 16. You can't do that. They've got to cut out those mistakes, and then you'll start to see the points mount. But you know what? A lot of times they don't score in the first quarter, but they're on the road to scoring, and a minute or so into the second quarter, they complete a drive and they're on the board.
Well, yeah, I was just going to say another record I've been watching with Saquon is the most rushing yards in the season. So he's on.
That's the one I spoke about.
For Eric season. Dickerson? You're talking about the whole league.
Yeah, you're talking about the whole league.
The whole league. He has a chance to break Eric Dickerson's record this year.
I don't think so.
No?
No, I don't think so. And here's why. Let me tell you why.
Okay.
Unless, now, if he keeps playing the way he's playing, he will still be in one pace. But mm-hmm. let's just so say, for example, we go into the last game of the season and the Eagles are playing the Giants. They'd be playing the Giants here. So this would be game 17. Let's say at that point, the Eagles are locked into the first spot or the second spot. They're locked into a spot for the playoffs. So a win will not make any difference. They'll either be the first spot, to be the second spot. You don't really believe that Nick Sirianni is going to trust Saquon Barkley out there. And even if he wanted to, he couldn't send him out there without the starting offensive line. So there's no way that if the Eagles are doing what they've been doing, he's going to be out there in the last game of the season. So he'll probably fall a little short.
Yeah, he'll rest him.
Well, these coaches have both the offensive line and the defensive line playing at a high rate. And if injuries happen, they plug other people in.
Lou, do you know where the overall defense is ranked right now in the National Football League?
Number one.
That's number one defense in the NFL. The last time I think that happened, it was the Bud Carson defense in 1991, ranked first against the run, first against the pass, and first overall. But that had a couple of guys on it named Reggie White, Jerome Brown, Clyde Simmons, Seth Joyner, so on down the line.
I was going to mention Jerome Brown when you finished because he stuffed the run. He was unbelievable and a great character, a wonderful personality. Buddy Ryan loved him like a son. And I see some of that in the kid from Georgia. He can take on three guys himself.
He's good. There's no doubt about it. Somebody asked Nick or asked Vic to compare him to Jerome Brown, and they both said not so fast. He's a great player. He's doing very well, but he's got a lot to learn. So it's too early to take a second-year player and nominate him for Canton.
Yeah, and that's hard to believe it's only his second year. Because it was
only his second year.
Beginning of last season, he was raw.
He's still a little bit raw. And guys, they're getting double-teamed and tackled. And I hope this week that the Eagles sent a tape to the league and said, take a look at this. Some of those holds are called.
Who was the kid early in the game that had three quick penalties and they were singling him out as being another Derek, whatever Derek's name was? You know who I'm talking about? Three quick penalties.
You mean Derek Barnett?
The player that they said it's always him. That was in the past.
I think that was Derek Barnett.
Derek Barnett. Right. Yeah. Right.
Well, who was getting called for the penalties? It might have been Landon Dickerson. He's had a few.
Okay. Because someone said he's another Derek. So anyway, we were talking before the show about some of your interests. You're 100% football guy or 92%. Do you stay up and watch other games as well? Are you a football fanatic?
I am. I am a football fanatic. I will be up until the very end of the Detroit Green Bay tonight. because that's a big game.
Oh, wow.
I watch Monday Night Football. And if I get home early enough and we don't have a night game, I watch Sunday Night Football. I will be up, believe me, I will be up Saturday night at 8 o'clock when the Nittany Lions go up against Oregon for the Big Ten Championship.
Oh,
so
yeah.
football, I think you have the idea, is my very, very favorite.
Now, how do you handle these late night things? Do you take a nap during the day?
No, I just watch them and then go get my 6 hours sleep.
Well, we also were talking earlier about other sports. You said you follow the Phillies.
I do. I love the Phillies. I've been watching the Phillies I've been watching the Phillies since I was listening to the Phillies as a young kid.
Well, I'm a big Phillies fan, too. Of course, growing up, that's pretty much what we had. The Eagles were not a major entity in Philadelphia. Of course, there was no hockey, and I predated the NBA. So, and the Big Five was not a thing. But the Phillies have been dear to my heart for many, many years. And some of the announcers, you know, I go back to Kelly. He was
Gene Kelly.
He was the greatest. I thought he was fantastic. When there was a rain delay, he didn't throw it back to the station like they do now. He stayed on the air on TV, and I kept it for 35, 45 minutes. I kept showing pictures of the field. He kept interviewing people. And then, of course, he was hurt in an auto accident and was never really the same.
Well, you know, he broke my heart. He really did. I grew up like you. I love Gene Kelly. I would turn on the radio as a kid, and within 15 seconds, I would know whether the Phillies were winning or losing. You could just hear it, and all of his expressions. It's let's take the seventh inning stretch, tug on your cap, rub your noses, and knock on wood.
Oh, my gosh, yeah.
Or Ballantyne blast, or, you know, he had it all.
Yes,
I did love Gene Kelly. And one time, they used to have a contest called the Junior Sportscaster Contest, brought to you by Atlantic Gasoline. And what you had to do was write a letter of 100 words or less of why you wanted to be a sportscaster when you grew up. And somebody who became a friend of mine by the name of Phil Jasner won 1 year and got, as a prize, he got to do a half an inning or a few batters during a Phillies game from the broadcast booth with those guys. But I would send my letter in, and I would never hear every year. Wait, go run to the mailbox.
Aww.
I never heard. So one time I just sent a letter to Gene Kelly, and I said to him, "Dear Mr. Kelly, I would love to be a broadcaster someday. Do you have any advice?" And a few weeks later, I got a letter back, and it was postmarked St. Louis, where the Phillies had been playing. And it was written to me by Gene Kelly, and he had all kinds of things in there by saying, you know, you play as many games as you possibly can, and don't forget Branch Rickey Sr. said, luck is the residue of hard work, and did all those things. It was a very, very nice letter, which I still to this day have in a scrapbook. I carried it around with me for a year.
Oh, wow.
I never let it out of my sight. So now I go to college. And in one of what should have been the greatest night of my life, at the end of my freshman year, we would have a WRTI station banquet. And at the banquet, they would have a guest speaker, and also they would announce the staff for the next year. Now, before that year, Gene Kelly was fired as the Phillies announcer. Ultimately, he went on to broadcast the games of the Cincinnati Reds and did some other things. But at any rate, I had never met him. But the guest speaker that night was Gene Kelly, and I was so excited. So first, they announced the staff for WRTI for my sophomore year. And who do they name as sports director of WRTI but me? So that is the greatest thing that can ever happen to me. I'm going to be doing all the Temple games. And then when the banquet opened and ended, naive me went up to Gene Kelly and I said, "Mr. Kelly, what do you think of the Phillies this year?" And he said, "I don't care about the Phillies. I root for people, not about teams. And right now, all I care about is Gene Kelly." And I was like, oh, wow. My goodness. You mean he really doesn't love the Phillies? I mean, yeah, sure he's not going to love the Phillies. He was just fired by them going into that season. But naive me thought he still loves his Phillies. That's when I grew up. Now, years later, after I had come out of the Navy, I was a Navy ensign and lieutenant public affairs officer. I came back, and at this point, I'm looking for a job, and nobody would hire me. And Gene Kelly was back in town, and he was working for Channel 48. And I called him, and I said, can I come down and help you out? And he said, yeah, kid, come down here. So I would go down there, and I would drive all over the place, wherever he had to go. And I would drive him down to the airport in the spring, because there was no electronic feeds or satellite. I would have to go there with him to pick up film that was being sent back to him from Clearwater, Florida, where the Phillies were on spring training, and he would use them in his sportscast. So we're driving back on a Friday afternoon. Channel 48 was located right off the expressway, and it was hot, and it was humid, and that we were in a traffic jam, and we're sitting there in traffic, and we're sitting there in traffic. And then Gene Kelly says, you know, whoever thought me, Gene Kelly, would have to depend on you, Merrill Reese, and nothing. That's what he said.
And oh, my gosh.
I dropped him off at Channel 48 and never came back again.
Wow. I think he was affected mentally by the accident, and it might have, you know, caused him to be a little, and being fired, being bitter.
Well, it certainly changed him. But think about me at that point, a 25-year-old young guy with my hopes and my dreams.
Yeah.
And I was hurt by that. Now, later, I would see him at ball games. And as a matter of fact, once I started doing the Eagles, he would call me at the station and say to me, hey, you have anything Gene Kelly can do on the pregame show? And I was always polite. I never said anything, but do you know who my real idol was, Lou? My real idol was Bill Campbell.
There you go.
I love Bill Campbell. I would go to Franklin Field, and I would look up at the broadcast booth and say, that's where I want to be someday. And then when the play started, I'd look down on the field, and then I'd go back looking up at Bill Campbell. But Bill Campbell and I became lifelong friends, and he was – Cindy and I were at the wedding celebration when he and his lovely wife, Jo, celebrated their 50th wedding anniversary by getting married all over again. And then I was chosen by his wife and by his lovely daughter, Chris, to read scripture at his funeral. Mm-hmm. After he passed away, I went to the church over in Haddonfield.
Right.
And Bill and I became very, very close friends.
Well, they didn't call him the dean for nothing. He was the best.
In fact, yeah, I was the first recipient of the Bill Campbell Award after he passed away, given at the Philadelphia Sports Writers Dinner. I've got two of those. I've got the Bill Campbell Award, and I've got the Harry Callis Award.
Wonderful.
Wow.
Well, Merrill, so wonderful to have you on. I know it's not 50 years, but like you said, it seems like forever. And you're
it's
going
only 48, to be 48, Lou.
You're going to, well, next time we have you on, it'll be 49, probably.
No, Lou, Sis will probably call me in 3 weeks.
I was looking for your jacket. I want to say congratulations again for your entrance into the Football Hall of Fame.
Thank you, Susan. That's a great thrill, but I didn't get a jacket.
What did they give you?
Well, I was the winner, this year's 2024 winner, of the Pete Rozelle Award, which is for excellence in radio and television. So that's my entry into the Hall of Fame. But the players and coaches, they receive the gold jackets. But I was at that same dinner, and I was called upon to speak and do a whole presentation. And it was a great feeling to be able to address these people. And one of the things I said in my address was how grateful I was, and that every day, every game, home, away, when we stand for the national anthem, I say to myself, and I do every game, I look down from the broadcast booth and I say, There is nothing, there is no place in the world I would rather be, and there is nothing in the world I would rather be doing.
Oh, well, on that beautiful note, Merle, we're going to let you go. And you're a Philadelphia treasure and a good friend. And thank you so much for coming on. It's always an honor to have you.
Thank you, Lou.
All right. We want to make sure our viewers and listeners go to themuseumofsports.org to make a tax-deductible contribution today, so you can be part of Philly Shrine at the redesigned South Philadelphia Sports Complex. And don't forget to buy my new book. 2 years old now. Blades, Bands, and Ballers, How Flash and Cash, that's me and a fellow named Ed Snyder, rescued the Flyers and created Philadelphia's greatest showplace. Just go to the museumofsports.org website for a personalized copy for dad or a friend. I guarantee they'll love it. In fact, if they don't like it, I'll give you your money back. Don't give out my address, okay? When we come back, boxing promoter Jay Russell Peltz will be with us when the Museum of Sports Show returns on Talk 860 and Facebook Live.
It was 1967, and Philadelphia was in a rut. The economy, riots, Vietnam. That is, until the Broad Street Bullies rallied the region's spirits and brought more than 2 million into the streets to celebrate. You can read all about it in Lou Scheinfeld's candid memoir, Blades, Bands, and Ballers, available on Amazon and Barnes & Noble. You'll love the inside stories about Frank Sinatra, Ed Snyder, Bernie Parent, Frank Rizzo, Elvis Presley, the 76ers, Mick Jagger, Electric Factory Concerts, and Kate Smith. And you'll find out how Lou Scheinfeld helped Ed Snyder rescue the Flyers and, against all odds, got the Spectrum built. Blades, Bands, and Ballers. Get a signed first edition copy at themuseumofsports.org. Themuseumofsports.org. The book the Philadelphia Inquirer called a fascinating and hilarious read. Blades, Bands, and Ballers. An ode to a building that truly rocked. The Museum of Sports Show is presented by Depatchi Franklin Cardiovascular and Autonomic Center. Dr. Nicholas Depatchi is a caring specialist who uses natural antioxidants, nitric oxide, and anti-inflammatory agents to treat heart disease, hypertension, palpitations, and more with minimum medicines. To learn more, please call Dr. Nicholas Depatchi, MD, FACC, author of 4 books and over 100 articles and abstracts, at 856-589-6034. That's 856-589-6034.
Did you miss a recent Museum of Sports show? No worries. You can see or listen to any of our previous shows on the Museum of Sports website or on our Facebook page. You'll love our lineup of great guests, including Merrill Reese, the Eagles' Vive Sekahema, Bill Berge and Kevin Riley, Flyers broadcasters Jim Jackson and Steve Coates, and the Phillies' always colorful Larry Boa. The Museum of Sports is on the air and Facebook, and you can join the fun every Thursday, 4 to 5 p.m. on WWDB 860 and Facebook Live. All right, we're back on the Museum of Sports Show on Talk 860 and on the Facebook pages of the Museum of Sports and Talk 860. We're brought to you by Depatchi Franklin Cardiovascular Center, specialists in non-invasive treatment. I'm Lou Scheinfeld, along with Denver Broncos superfan Susan Baxter. Our next guest began promoting fights almost when he was still in diapers. And though he says he's retired now at the age of whatever, he still got his hand in the boxing business in terms of following it closely and being honored. I think he's in 623 Halls of Fame now, all over the world. Russell Peltz, welcome back to the Museum of Sports Show.
Pleasure to be here with the man who started Monday Night Fights at the Spectrum.
Well, you know what? I'll tell a quick story about that. I said to Ed Snyder, you know, we have nothing on Monday nights. And there's this guy, Russell Peltz, putting on great fights at the arena and the Blue Horizon and all. Why don't we start a Monday night boxing program? He said, how much? That's what he cared. How much? I said, $1 million for 1 year. He said, $1 million? Are you crazy? I said, $20,000. For a card every Monday for 1 year. He said, we'll go broke. He said, we'll lose $500,000. I said, well, that you could stop paying me if that happens. He says, I'm going to hold you to that. So I call Russell. I said, what do you think? He says, I'd love to do it. I said, I got to sell Ed Snyder on it. I said, I'll get back to you before the end of the year. New Year's Eve, I meet with Ed finally. And after several drinks, he agrees to do the $1 million over 52 weeks. And but he warned me and all that. So I'm riding home in my car, and I had his car phone back in that day, in the days. Sure. And I call Russell at home, and I say, Russell, and he says, oh, I guess it didn't. I said, well, do you want to be the sports boxing director of the Spectrum? Oh, my God, yes. And that's how it started. And okay. Russell is not only a wonderful promoter, but a decent human being. He can make a deal with anyone. A handshake means everything to him. He is loved and respected by everybody in the boxing business. He has owned boxers or owned their contracts. He has promoted all over the world. He created the great boxing program at the Spectrum with the Philadelphia middleweights in the 80s, which was, we were doing more fights than Madison Square Garden. Russell, you've had a great career, but you're not out of it completely, are you?
I guess I'm the manager of about a half a dozen fighters. Just trying to help them out. You know, some of them have losing records. Some of them are on the other side of the hill, but it just keeps my hand in it.
Well, you got to do something because Linda, she says, like my wife said, I married you for better or worse, but not for lunch. So it's good that you keep going and it keeps your mind sharp, but you must have some great, great memories. I guess Benny Briscoe was one of the best, but there are so many others.
It was, listen, people today, Lou, have no idea how big boxing was in this country. At least, you know, whenever I speak, I tell, you know, baseball was invented basically in 1854. So from 1854 until 1958, there was only three professional sports in this country that anybody cared about. And in alphabetical order, they're baseball, boxing, and horse racing. But it was really boxing. I mean, I tell people in 1927, Gene Tunney got $990,000 to fight Jack Dempsey in Soldier Field. And that same year, on one of the greatest Yankee teams of all time, Babe Ruth made $70,000, and the entire Yankee payroll was $250,000. But I use 1958 as the cutoff because that was the year of the Colts-Giants championship sudden-death playoff game, which jump-started pro football. But listen, before 1967, there was no ice hockey on the East Coast. I mean, in Philly, for sure. You know, forever it was six teams, two of them in Canada. And I think the year the Sixers won the title in 67, some of those games were still on tape delay. So boxing was a monster. I mean, we were drawn in the 70s, 8, 9, 10,000 people a show at the Spectrum. And but I tell people today that sports teams are building multi-million dollar arenas and boxing promoters are looking for National Guard armories and catering halls.
Well, you mentioned boxing being nationally huge, but in Philadelphia, boxing was big. I remember growing up boxing. My dad took me to the arena to see fights. I remember Jersey Joe Walcott, and of course, Joe Frazier came along a while later, but when Walcott was fighting, and he fought Lewis, he fought Marciano, I believe, that was huge. And Joey Giardello and some of the others in Philadelphia. And the Philadelphia fighter became like a name, didn't it?
Yeah. For many years, the Philadelphia fighter was, as they say, always the bridesmaid, but never the bride. We had a lot of number one contenders. But, you know, then Giardello came along in 63 and Harold Johnson in 62. And then it opened up a little bit, but nobody wanted to come to Philly to fight. They were all afraid. It was murder getting guys from New York to come to Philly, even in the 70s. But the money was so good in Philly that they came.
Well, and
how do you feel? Oh, I'm sorry, Lou.
Go ahead. No, go.
I didn't want to change. I was just going to say, how did you feel about the fight last month? and Tyson's career and his comeback.
I think it was sad that the biggest fight of the year was Jake Paul and Mike Tyson. But Mike Tyson, when you think about it, he was the last, not only heavyweight champ, he was the last boxing world champion that the average sports fan knows about.
The
guys that came after Tyson, Lennox Lewis, Klitschko, Holyfield, none of them could compare to Tyson's name. So when Tyson was still around, we were drawing people who would go to football games, basketball games, baseball games, because Mike Tyson was, in fact, the baddest man on the planet. Yeah. But now he's 58 years old, and he's not even the baddest man in his own household. But 71,000 people paid to see him.
Russ, I want to get your opinion on something. Joe Frazier, world champion, Philadelphia kind of native. Wonderful guy, had his family here and everything. We built a statue. He is, in my opinion, he is not revered in Philadelphia as he should be. Is that because he wasn't warm and fuzzy or what? I mean, his gym is going by the wayside. His name is not as well known, overshadowed by L.E. and the Rocky statue. Joe Frazier, I don't think got his due.
You're probably, listen, I was there the night, I was in the garden the night he fought Ali. Not only the greatest boxing event ever, in my mind, the greatest sporting event ever. When you consider that Ali was known in Australia, in Uganda, in the Philippines, in Paris. What American athlete can you name that had the worldwide name that he was the most famous person in the world in his heyday? But so Frazier suffered in his shadow. But the night he beat Ali in the garden that first time, he would have been a handful for any heavyweight champion who ever lived. The thing about Frazier was when he started making money, he moved out of the city into Plymouth White Marsh. So all the good Philly fighters used to hang out on the street corners. You know, Broad and Columbia, they were street guys. Frazier was never really what you called a street guy. He sort of separated himself from the city in a sense. And I think him supporting Richard Nixon didn't help him too much.
Yeah, he was a good human being.
Yes,
and he was a good citizen, never in trouble, never caused any problems out of the ring. And you know, Dr. DePace, our benefactor for the memorabilia, was his dear friend and doctor for many, many years and supported him. And he even bought him that pink Cadillac that Joe wanted when he wanted to become a singer. And I don't know if I said this last time, but the family put it up for sale after he passed away, and Dr. DePace bought it back and gave it to them. And said, here, so please don't sell it to anybody else.
Mark Cram Jr. wrote a wonderful book about Frazier about 5 years ago, and it talks about all the things he did to help out ordinary citizens if he'd see them on the street, if their car broke down, things like that. He really went out of his way for people. A lot of things I never knew about him.
We had Mark Cram on the show about 2 years ago, and we'll get him back to talk about Frazier. But what do you think about the gym? Is it historic enough to preserve, or does it mean anything?
You know, Lou, when they failed to preserve the Blue Horizon, which honestly is a bigger landmark than Frazier's gym, I don't see. Well, there wasn't as much social media around then as there is now. So it's possible that all the talk about Frazier's gym could get somewhere with the Preservation Society. I mean, we virtually lived there in the 70s and 80s. And so many great fighters, not just the Philly guys.
Oh, you muted.
You got muted.
When we bring fighters in from out of town for a week ahead of time for press, they'd all train there. Tommy Hearns, Emil Griffith, Hegeman Lewis, Yaki Lopez. I mean, Ken Norton, and Frazier trained for the first Ali fight there in March of 71. He had gone away to the Catskills to train, but the snow was so bad he couldn't run in the morning. So he came back to Philly, and Marvis, his son, would charge $2 a head at the door to anyone who wanted to come and see him train with Norton and Larry Holmes. And the gym was packed every afternoon. It was a landmark, and it was a beautiful gym. Not that you want a boxing gym to be beautiful, but it was just an iconic place.
Well, like my love for newspapers, and you started out as a newspaper man as well at the Bulletin. I'm a newspaper junkie. I mentioned earlier that when I go to a train station or an airport, I look in trash cans if they're open. And if there happens to be a New York Post on top and it looks clean, I'll take it because I love newspapers. But we're seeing the demise of newspapers, and you must feel the same way about boxing. It's sad. Things change. What we grew up loving and respecting and thought would be bedrock forever, they go away. And I don't want to say we will too one day, but things change. And you have to, I saw a line today that said, if you don't evolve, you die.
I don't know if I agree with that. I mean, change is not always for the better. And what I've told people, you know, the demise of newspapers hurt boxing because an Eagles fan would pick up the Bulletin or the Inquirer, the Daily News, and want to read about the Eagles. And while he's turning the pages, he'd see a boxing story and maybe he would read it. Now, the only people that read the boxing stories are the boxing fans that go to the boxing websites, and the football fans go to the football websites, and the basketball fans go to the basketball websites. So there's very little crossover, and that hurts.
Yeah,
people don't realize that.
Yeah, and another thing, before we let you go, the advent of boxing in Atlantic City didn't help the Philadelphia scene either.
Well, the advent, listen, I can't complain about the 80s because it was a license to print money in Atlantic City, the way they were falling over each other, spending money to get the exposure on television. But yeah, casinos killed cities like Philly because you couldn't compete. They were paying no rent, no hotel rooms, no meals. You didn't have to pay for it. You didn't have to print the tickets. You didn't have to sell the tickets. You didn't have to hire ushers. The only thing you had to do was pay the fighters. And so not only did you not have those expenses, they would pay the promoter a fee on top of that. So it was tough to walk away from.
Well, I'm glad to hear you're still involved, helping out some boxers who probably wouldn't have much of a opportunity otherwise. But always wonderful to have you on and to see you, Russell. And we'll have one of our lunches coming up soon at Murray's. So Meantime, stay well. Don't get too burnt in that sun down there, okay?
Okay, take care, Susan. Nice seeing you.
Seeing you, Russell.
Okay, all right, when we come back, our king of sports collectibles, Nick Nicholas Tapachi Jr. will tell you what's hot in the sports memorabilia collection world when the Museum of Sports Show continues here on Talk 860 and Facebook Live.
Can you imagine Philadelphia without the Broad Street Bullies or its fabled Spectrum Arena? Well, it almost happened until Lou Scheinfeld and Ed Snyder, otherwise known as Flash and Cash, teamed up to rescue the Flyers and got America's Showplace up and running. It was 1967, and the world was in a whole different place. You can read all about it in Lou Scheinfeld's heartfelt memoir, Blades, Bands, and Ballers. Get a signed copy at themuseumofsports.org. Themuseumofsports.org. Blades, Bands, and Ballers, now available. The Museum of Sports Show is presented by Tapachi Franklin Cardiovascular and Autonomic Center. Dr. Nicholas Tapachi is a caring specialist who uses natural antioxidants, nitric oxide, and anti-inflammatory agents to treat shortness of breath, brain fog, chronic disease, autonomic dysfunction syndrome, and more with minimum medicines. To learn more, please call Nicholas Tapachi, MD, FACC, at 856-589-6034. That's 856-589-6034.
Who remembers the Philadelphia A's or the Warriors or the old arena at 46th and Market? We do, and that's why the Museum of Sports is being planned for Philadelphia. What's it like to face a 100-mile-an-hour fastball, ride your bike up the Maniunk Wall, or drive in the Pocono 500? We've got rare items from Babe Ruth, Mike Schmidt, Chuck Bednar, Bernie Perron, and Wilt Chamberlain. The Museum of Sports is on the air, and you can join the fun every Thursday, 4 to 5 p.m. on WWDB 860.
Hey, buddy, what can I get you? How about the ultimate sports memorabilia basement?
All right, we're back on the Museum of Sports Show, brought to you by the Tapachi Franklin Cardiovascular Center. They are the specialists in non-invasive treatment. I'm Lou Scheinfeld, along with Susan Baxter. Doug Scheimel is off today. He's actually up in the woods in the Poconos with bunch of guys. They do this every year. I hope they have some heat. Anyway, here is our king of sports collectibles, whose family has the world's largest and most valuable memorabilia collection worth more than $50 million. And they're our partner in the Museum of Sports, finalizing a home in the new South Philly Sports Complex. Everybody say hi to Nick Tapachi Jr.
How's it going, everybody?
Going good, really going good. Had a wonderful meeting with Compass Spectacor this week, and working towards getting our museum as part of their phase one of their $2.5 billion upgrade of the sports complex. So I want to fill you in on that later on, off the air, and your dad. So we're very excited about it. So what's happening in your world? I see that people are coming to the museum over in Sewell, New Jersey, where you have, I'd say, what, half of your collection available, or maybe 30%?
And we're still unboxing.
Still in boxes. So what have you discovered lately? Anything new?
I don't remember the last thing that we discovered that was new. But every day we're getting something. I think we unboxed some football jerseys the other day.
I saw a Pete Retzlaff jersey last week. I think it was a little crinkled up, number 44. And I won't ask you how many jerseys you have of
I lost count
of all sports, Olympics, college, pro, international, boxers, everything. But anybody who wants to get blown away by an explosion of memorabilia should go over to the Dapachi Sports Museum, go online to their website and make an appointment. It's not open to the public on a walk-in basis yet. That'll be in the fall, I believe. But right now you could get a personal guided tour around this magnificent, it is mind-blowing. It's the only term I could use. And you've got some wonderful people there that'll walk you through, and there's no charge. You know, if you want to tip the guy a couple thou, that's fine on the way out or whatever.
Pay the rent.
I've seen it 50 times, and I'm blown away every time. There aren't electronic experiential things to do. That'll come later when we have the museum in Philadelphia. But they have everything. And when I say everything, I mean everything. You name a sport. You say horse racing. Oh, we got Man of War, rose-covered thing that went over, rose blanket when he won the blah, blah, blah. Boxing. Oh, we have Ali and Fraser's gloves and robes and this. Frank Sinatra, what's he got to do with it? Well, there's a story with him with his Joe DiMaggio and the set of clubs and a rivalry over Marilyn Monroe. What's it got to do with sports? And a lot. There's so many great tie-ins, and they got this. They have Frank Sinatra's bar that was at the casino for when he would come down to Atlantic City. He had his own bar set up, and they have that, and they have so much else. If you want to talk about the beginning of basketball in Philadelphia, the advent of the Big Five, the Warriors, before that, the Spas, SPHAWS, mm-hmm. South Philadelphia Hebrew Association, which was a bunch of little Jewish guys who went around the East Coast playing big, tough other teams. That was the beginning of basketball in Philadelphia. And boxing. We just got off the air with Russell Peltz, a great boxing promoter, and I could go on forever, but it's Nicholas's segment, so I'll let him talk. Now, we just had a great meeting with Compass Spectacor. Things are moving along swiftly, although that they won't be ready to open till about 2027, and we expect to be part of that opening as well. And that's going to include a 5,500-seat arena, an office building, restaurants, stores, residential. There'll be apartments as well. So it's going to be on both sides of Patterson Avenue because the Phillies are 50-50 partners. Excuse me. I don't want to give anything away that they haven't announced yet, but it's going to be spectacular. It's going to be a bustling 24/7 embellishment at the end of the subway, 20 minutes from Center City, across the bridge from New Jersey and down the road from Delaware. And even though the 76ers may be not part of that and gone by 2031, It's going to be spectacular. So we're so excited to be part of that. And Nick, I know your dad is looking forward to it. We're going to, in addition to the fantastic collection that you have, we're going to have experiential things like what's it like to ride your bike up the Manayunk Wall? What's it like to row in the Dad Vale Regatta? What's it like to race at the Pocono 500, which I think is 300 now, but that's at reverse inflation. So, but Nick, and it'll give you a lot more room to put things out. And what does somebody expect when they walk into your museum? Do they? I know they look around because everything is so dazzling and all. But what do you think are some of the most attractive aspects that people go gaga over?
Well, immediately they're going to be drawn to the boxing ring where Mike Tyson knocked out Sphinx in the Trump Taj Mahal or Trump Plaza. And in the middle of that ring are the bronze statues, 7 feet tall, of Frazier giving the left hook to Muhammad Ali.
In the fight of the century, 1971, that J. Russell Peltz just said was not only the greatest boxing event in history, but one of the biggest sports events ever. The attention it drew, and Ali, as he pointed out, was known all over the world, all over the world. Everybody knew him. Joe Frazier, you know, was a champion, and Frazier beat him, and that was one of the biggest sporting events. Now, that's back in 71. That's over 50 years ago, and boxing has become so fragmented because you could weigh 2 pounds more and go into another classification because there's so many subclassifications. But again, this is what you're going to see if you go over there. That ring, and across from the ring on the wall is the ringside bell from the Dempsey-Tunney fight, 1926, at Municipal Stadium in Philadelphia. And the reports were there were 130,000 people at that fight.
In the rain, I believe.
In the rain. And it was a world-known fight. And Philadelphia, of course, was a big fight town then. There's so much. You know, every city says, oh, we got the greatest sports town in the world, fans. No, we got them here. And I just read something from the Wall Street Journal in the early part of the show where the Eagles fans are known all over the country. You know, now that
all over the world.
All over the world. That's true. That's true.
Especially in London.
Rio. They were just in
Brazil,
Rio, right?
Yeah.
Rio has never seen anything like that, you know. And Rio's been around a long time.
Just getting back to the actual where they're putting, and I'm excited about the build of the sports museum and the location. But I'm more excited that they are mirroring Battery Park, because let me tell you, when you're walking, I've been in Atlanta many times, been to the games at the Braves. The fact that you're not walking with cars down there is going to be a blessing in Philadelphia, because once they lift the pedestrian foot traffic up and there's going to be access from all the stadiums, that is going to help so much. I mean, I'm really looking forward to the layout and the design of how, and the safety of the fans, because that is one thing that when you're walking around game to game, and especially if there's more than one event going on down there, it's tough. You have to park somewhere and then you walk, and it's like, you know, you crossing the road and driving, either you're driving or you're, and everybody's on the same street. And I think once they build this and they're going to have the levels, it's going to be phenomenal.
Yeah, their plans are hopefully will be announced in the first quarter of next year, maybe even in January. There's a lot of legal lease has to be done, city zoning, city asset rights, all kinds of stuff I don't understand. That's why we pay the lawyers, get the documents signed and so forth. And as Nick Jr. knows, we got the stuff. We got the stuff to put in it, in the museum. It'll be family friendly. It'll be open all the time. If there's no event down there, we're open. If there's a Phillies afternoon game, come over after the game. If it's a night game, come in before the game. We're working with Dan Hilferty and his wonderful staff, Phil Laws, who's in charge of the complex down there. The Phillies are a 50% partner of this, so they're 50-50 with Comcast Spectacor. This thing is going to happen. It's not just what they call I forget what they call it, something way in the future, you know. This is happening. They're putting a lot of money behind it, their own money. And fortunately, we're on the inside to hear all this, and it's very exciting. So we can't wait.
Well, Nick, do you have anything to add in our last minute of our broadcast here?
I think you and Lou covered everything. We can't have a better promoter for the museum than Lou.
Well, look, Doug is off, so we got a chance to talk. So now don't tell him I said that. All right. All right. Well, look, I think that's all the time we have for this week. We want to thank our guests, the great Merle Reese, boxing guru J. Russell Peltz, and our king of sports collectibles, Nick Tepachi Jr.
I'm a little early with that.
The Museum of Sports Show is brought to you by Tepachi Franklin Cardiovascular Center. They are specialists in non-invasive treatment. For Susan Baxter, I'm Lou Scheinfeld, reminding you what our good friend Carly Simon always says, these are the good old days.
Yes, they are.